गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय ताद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय। हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। श्री गौर नित्यानंद गौर गदाधर जी की जय। श्री राधा मनमोहन राधा गोविंद देव राधा गोपीनाथ जी की जय। गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रमाण हरि अगेन वेलकम टू ऑल गेटिंग टुगेदर वन मोर टाइम फॉर इन सेक्रेट सर्कल सेक्रेट वैष्णव असेंबली ट्राइंग टू ऑल ऑफ अस bring together the presence of Bhagavan deeply and deeply in our hearts. Bhagavan, Bhagavati. That's basically how Krishna is defining Sadhu Sangha in the Bhagavad Gita. And they say, I didn't say it, but these days I was thinking so much about this verse because it's very much like a verse you can use to describe what has been taking place these days, which is one of the four essential verses of the Bhagavad Gita, 9 verse 10 chapter. Krishna is basically defining what sadhu sangha. After having said what's a sadhu in the previous chapter, as we say, apichet sudaracharo, as we describe these days, someone utterly honest, then he says, machitamadgata prana katayantashtamam nityam bodayanta parasparam tusyant katayantashtamam nityam tusyanti charamantija. So my devotees are getting together with me in the center, Bodhayanta Parashparam. They enlighten one another. Parashparam, similar to parampara. Parampara means one after another. Parashparam means one another, each other, like mutually, like a mutual Bodhayanta. Bodhayanta means like enlightenment. So Sadhu Sangha means enlightening one another. It's mutual, it's reciprocal, it's not one way street. So Krishna is describing what his devotees do. They get together, they hang out to enlighten one another. what do you have to do today, Sunday evening? Let's hang out and get some mutual enlightenment. And here we are, with that hope. Right? Katayanta shramam nityam. And how they do that? Perpetually. Kataya, engaging in kata about me, talking about me. You know? And talking about Krishna, of course, as we have shown, it's not necessarily only saying Krishna is blue, he plays a flute, peacock feather, dances in Vrindavan with the gopi. Of course, all that's true as well. But all the things we have been talking about is Krishna kata, because it all revolves around how we can become a lover of God in the most wholesome, realistic, deep way. So it's all Krishna kata. Nityam. So Krishna says, perpetually they are doing that. In other words, they are doing that now, and they are finding tushyanti charamanti cha. They're finding so much nourishment and taste in that nityam. They are organizing themselves to continue doing this in eternity. They're making some plan. Let's do that for it. Let's do this forever. Let's organize the next retreat in eternity. That's basically what Goloka Vrindavan is about. No, it's like retreat for eternity. With those you feel are like-minded, your own family, your own tribe, and serving in eternity in the most pure, beautiful way. But it all begins with Sadhu Sangha. And the Sadhu Sangha now in time becomes more and more important. That's why Krishna Daska Viraj Goswami says, Jan Krishna Bhakti Jan Mamul Hoy Sadhu Sangha Krishna Pen Jan Meten Hopunar Mokyanga. Krishna, Sadhu Sangha is the root cause that gives birth to bhakti. Bhakti comes from bhakti, inherent or inherited. That verse is replying. I won't say more. The Jersey book, someone wrote about it. But then the verse says, Krishna Prem Janmeten Hapunar Mukyanga. And when you, Sadhu Sangha is crucial to begin bhakti, but when you attain Krishna Prem, Sadhu Sangha becomes all the more important. Then you realize the importance of Sadhu Sangha. When you attain divine love, then you realize how much more, how, what's real sadhusanga, how much more sadhusanga you can have in eternity. So, yeah, so these days we are receiving some appetizers of eternity, so to say. If this is like this, what must be? Yeah. Eternity, what must be? So hopefully all that is fueling. And in one sense, of course, if this is like this, what must be eternity? Well, eternity is showing itself here and now. So that's how we can get a glimpse of that and we can connect with that. So part of eternity will be Istagosti. There are eternal Istagostis going on, questions and answers on so many levels. No? Of course, in the Lilas, we were talking, I think, in Terni, in Italy. Maybe the daily Istagosti among the intimate associates of Radha and Krishna is how to keep Radha and Krishna alive in separation from each other. So how creative we have to do to be, to make the necessary arrangements to organize their reunion because they are no longer able to tolerate their separation in divine love. So what to do? Istagosti, no questions and answers. Yeah, literally, that's still an Istagosti. That's the ultimate Istagosti. Because Istagosti, Gosti means like reunion, and Ishta means around one's Ishta. So the Manjaris are reuniting literally around their Ishtadev, Sri Radha, who is fainted on the floor, dying in separation of Krishna, and they're asking to one another, no, what now? How to keep her from dying, how to make the questions and answers around her Ishta, around her Diti. And the Priyanarma Sakas are doing the exact same thing around Krishna in the same moment. Krishna is fainting in separation from Radha, and they are questioning what to do, how to organize for the next clandestine meeting. Remember, this is all in the underworld, so to say. It's subterranean, no? So that's even more, requires more creativity. That's why divine love is compared to creativity, it's the highest creative force. It needs to. So again, that's the ultimate Istagosti, eh? But we have to begin somewhere. So here we are. We are nobody, as we always say, it's who we are, but by the grace of Bhakti, by the arrangement of Yogamaya, Purnamasi, and all these beautiful angels and engines, agents. In eternity, our daily duty and service will be to save the life of God on a daily basis because they are dying in separation from each other. I'm nobody. We are nobody in one sense, but saving the life of God on a daily basis, that sounds very interesting arrangement. So better we start Istagosti here and now properly. So we are equipped with proper crafts and skills to know how to respond to the necessity of the moment. So love is the ultimate responsibility. And responsibility means response ability. No? What's your ability to respond to the need of the moment? No? That's why in the spiritual world we say they have the highest responsibility. They have the highest ability to respond to the need of the moment in the most creative way. So Istagosti here and now is a way of entering into that space, getting closer and closer. So that's a brief introduction to what we are supposed to be doing during the next few minutes. Also, I hope you had a good blind walking exercise. I saw a few, that was interesting. I was just talking with someone and it's interesting to see people walking with eyes closed and others guiding them. So I hope it was an experiential somatic exercise to further integrate the theoretical content of our morning class on divine ignorance. So as we have been saying, the idea today, we can entertain questions, hopefully related, ideally, unless there is some other urgency, but related to the topics of today, probably yesterday as well, since we didn't have Istagosti in connection to issues and tissues between guru and disciple. So, I don't know. I heard that there were many questions. So, I'm fasting my own seatbelt. I'm not telling you fasting your seatbelt. I'm fasting mine now. So, Jamuna, yes.
So talk about the guru being a potential in front of us. So then one may think that I have to copy and paste my guru. I have to be like my guru. I have to do what I have to fully follow in the footsteps of exactly what they do. Almost losing our own identity and copy and pasting the guru onto myself. What is his desires and my desires?
Because he is my own potential appearing in front of me.
This is my potential, nothing else. Here he is.
Yeah. I like how Jamuna phrases the questions. All right. He adds masala to the question, right? Purva Pakshi coming there, the opposing view. Like, Thank you for bringing some masala to the equation. So what do we mean by the guru is our own potential appearing in front of us? Again, does it mean we have to become a replica of that person and dress in the same way? And, well, if your guru is male and you're female, we have a problem there to begin with. or we have to adopt his or her mannerisms, and we have to have the same opinions on political issues. And if I hate eggplant, I have to love eggplant because my guru loves eggplant. That's more personal. Or anything, no? Because again, as you say, many times we may get to that point of absolute imitation. And of course the answer is no. No, we are not supposed to imitate our guru. Once someone asked Srila Bhakti Vallabh Tirtha Goswami Maharaj, he was a disciple, acharya, successor acharya of Bhakti Daita Madhav Maharaj, who was a disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Someone asked him, what's the difference between Anukaran and Anusharan? Anukaran means imitation. Anusharan means following to the footsteps. Again, be careful of conflating these two. As you have to be careful to conflate so many things, belonging and fitting in, etc. Sometimes we conflate imitating. Anukarana. No? Anukar, kar means to do, and anu means to do the same thing that the other person is doing. Anusara. Sara means essence. So anusara means to go after the essence, like to follow the essence of what the person is doing. Mm-hmm. One thing is to do what the person is doing, the other thing is to follow the essence of the internal essence of the external act. So someone asked him how to know the difference between the two. How do I know that I'm not imitating, basically? It's a genuine concern. No, we don't want to become imitators. The guru is not telling ideally the disciple, imitate me. And then I go to the question. So he said, and I appreciate the answer very simply, but very to the point, is the difference between imitation and following the footsteps is that you know which is the internal intention of the guru in doing whatever he or she's doing. So once you can contact from which place the guru is doing, then you can know if you can do that or not, if you should do that or not, or how you can do the same things according to your situation. So then it doesn't become imitation, because you contact the internal spirit of the action, and then you realize, okay, Guru Dev is doing this from this internal place, where I am in connection to that. Can I do that myself, or that will be sahaja imitation? Okay, maybe I cannot do that, but I can be inspired by that, and I can draw the inspiration and apply that to my person situation, right? Like if you study the life of Raghunath Das Goswami, hopefully you don't become inspired to imitate him, because that can become dangerous. We may need to call an ambulance, because we will start to sleep 2 hours per day, not eating, and doing a lifestyle that is, for most people, dangerous. For him, he was not even aware of that. He's not like, okay, I will put my alarm in my cell phone to sleep 2 hours. No. He will sleep 2 hours when he slept, you know, and things like that. So when we say that the guru is our own potential appearing in front of us, we are saying that in a dynamic way. No, we are not saying that in a literal way. You know, like whatever Gurudev is showing, you have to be that in all the external details of that. But we're talking about the the essence. A genuine guru is, we know the symptoms of a genuine guru. I know, which are the symptoms of a genuine guru? You made the exercise yesterday. In your list, you put some ideal features, so to say, of a teacher and a relation with the teacher that is deep, profound, inspiring. So can you share a few of those?
Humble.
Humble.
Compassionate.
Compassionate.
Kind and caring.
Okay, kind, caring.
Doesn't tell you what to do, but rather accompanies you on the journey.
Okay, yes.
Always a student.
Sincerity,
sincere.
Sincere.
Balanced humanity.
Again, sorry?
Balanced humanity.
Balanced humanity, okay. And again, so all the things. So we want all those things. We have those things on some level. On some other level, we feel we are falling short of those things. So a guru is someone who ideally is showing those things in a level of exposure that is, again, is mirroring back and showing us, don't be complacent with your present level of compassion, kindness, and balance. All this can be attained, and you can do that as well. No? So, but the point is how to do that in my own way. No? Again, so that's why we are saying the guru is accompanying the disciple in how to actualize those things in the unique, individuated way the disciple is meant to be. A disciple is to meant to be an individual. Mm-hmm. So again, a guru is not just like, do what I say, do what I do, think like I think, and become me. No, that sounds a little narcissistic or impersonal even. Like your goal is to become me in every respect. It's like, whoa. Even if I love the person and I'm totally charmed, the idea of becoming the person is just like very, very strange to say the least. So yeah, the guru is our own potential in the sense that it's an example of, and in the beginning, it all may start in imitation, of course. Again, as we say, beginning of relationships or practice, like we say today, the ducklings are imitating the mother duck. There's place for imitation. We are not condemning imitation. We are just saying at one point, the ducklings will be kicked off, how? Kicked out from home and like, have your life now. Sorry if it sounded a little rude. They will be with the ducklings will be invited for individuation. Right? That sounded better, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But go to the essence. Don't need cotton for every word I'm saying. You go to the essence of my points. So this is the same, no? The guru is our own, the guru is a potential in the sense that the guru is pointing. I say it's our own potential, but remember, I very quickly say guru is a servant of our potential and guru is a facilitator of potential. So the guru is showing a level of realization and depth that is inspiring to us, but very quickly he or she will be assisting us in attaining our potential as who we are, no? And not just imposing his, her own template. So that's why I'm trying to quickly say guru is our own potential. He's a facilitator of potential. So he's trying to activate our own potentials in who all that we can be and churning that and animating that, supporting that, supporting the disciple in his or her journey of individuation. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like Teresa, yeah.
No, Samaraj, I'm thinking another angle of looking at that is that why we are attracted to a particular person as a guru, what's flowing through them, you know, it's a calling. Through the guru comes a calling for us to be the best version of ourselves. So and it's in that way that our guru also is our potential standing in front of us because he or she is drawing that out.
Yeah. Yeah, because again, we should never, in connection to that, thank you, we should never relate to the guru separate from his or her degree of representation of Krishna. Like you cannot separate how Krishna is coming through that person, you cannot put that aside and just worship the person separate from that. If you do that, that becomes a personality cult. So the person may have his, her own unique qualities, but those become especially dear to us because all that happens in the context of Krishna coming to us through that person, of the call. If there wouldn't be a call, those would be like, yeah, some cool human features. but we have to be careful not to, again, not to worship the figure, the human representative of the guru separate from the call that is coming through that person to us. You follow my point? So because many times the guru, of course, is an individual, is a person, and we appreciate the degree of surrender of his heart for the divine to flow through that. But many times also, yeah, the divine will flow through the guru in ways that the guru himself or herself are not aware of that. No. Many times that happened. No? Like Srila Srila Marsh narrates many times he will go with to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur after a lecture and tell him some point that he mentioned in class, and he'll be, I never say that. I didn't say that. And he was convinced. I didn't say that. And it's like, yeah, you say it, it's transcribed. No, I didn't say that. No? So something was like passing through them. No? So sometimes that becomes more overt. Sometimes it's more, there is still inspiration, but when it's aware of the inspiration come, there are degrees of all this, right? Sometimes when you may be sharing something and realize, wow, this thing I'm sharing is so cool. But it's not me, something else coming. In some cases, you don't even remember that you said that the current was too powerful to even keep awareness of what's taking place at that moment. And so yeah, I think that's always important. Something else? Who first?
I just wanted to add to the previous one. I was just thinking that, like, in each moment, like, every one of us is invited to be a guru and a disciple, like a disciple to learn from guru around us, and as a guru to serve.
I didn't get the last part. Each of us is invited to be a guru and disciple at the same time, and
in each moment, and as a disciple likes to learn, like, you know, like guru can manifest any like in anything and anyone, and as a guru like to serve, as in help or, you know, in service. Is that?
You are asking for confirmation of your theory.
Yeah, I was kind of like thinking about it. That is, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate the point. I mean, we talked about it, but I appreciate your bringing it again. That because we like to identify ourselves as students forever, as Srila Siddha Maharaj will say. But at the same time, somehow or other, we, one way or another, we are also gurus for someone, elders, and sometimes it can be false humility escaping from that. Like, no, I'm so fallen. Who am I to be guru of anyone? No. And actually, it's no, you have to. You are a father, you're a mother, you're a husband, you're a wife, you exist. Right? No. Again, being a guru doesn't mean that has nothing to do with my own merit and maybe special or better. I mean, potentially gurus everywhere, no? So it's just me allowing that to happen through me. No? Blade of grass is guru. Tree is guru. Prostitute is guru. Spider is guru. So yeah. If I say, yeah, but I cannot be guru. Why not?
No? Yeah, I was thinking it's not so much a formal thing, but it just kind of happens.
Exactly. Yeah. Of course, there is a formality to those who give initiation, but again, for me, it's, and I don't want to sound too broad to the point that Maharaj, it seems like you are like watering down the idea of guru and it disappeared in every single atom now. No, I'm not saying that. There's an importance to having guides in our life, mentors, and so on, but also sometimes we like over-localized the notion of guru and like reductionistic, and it's only here, and we lose sight that it's everywhere else. So yeah, we are called to be students, disciples, always, and at the same time, guru. I mean, if you are a good disciple, you're a guru. I mean, even if you don't want, the bare fact that you are a good student of life, you naturally become guru for everyone. that's a real guru. Real guru is someone who is so in one sense, there is no escape. No, whenever you become one thing, you end up becoming the other. Unofficially, no, we are not talking about titles and rituals and ceremony here, but in more substance, because you can have the title, you can even give an initiation and be a sexual predator at the same time. No, that happens. No, really. So what was that? No? Oh, he's a guru. No, he's a guru. Sure. One second.
Yes.
He's a guru. Yeah. He's a guru. Okay. in which form? With all respect. No? And someone else is a spider. And that spider is not acknowledged in any parampara. No, as an acharya, is not receiving any om Vishnupad Paramahamsa, but it's a guru according to the Bhagavatam. So we have to keep the broadest possible definition of anything in mind when we talk about anything, not only guru, especially when we talk about guru. But when we talk about anything, we should keep the broadest possible definition. So whenever we approach that idea, we're not doing it in an exclusivistic, over-localized, this is only what guru is. This is only what grace is, what Krishna is, what anything is. What's the broadest possible definition? Krishna is the first guru. Krishna is everywhere. Guru is everywhere. That's quite broad. There is not a place where guru is not. That's shastrically approved. We are not here creating a new sampradaya. That's sustained by logic applied in connection to revelation. We call that shastra yukti. Yukti means like logic. So we exercise our logical thinking in connection to what the scriptures reveal. Revelation says God is the original guru. Revelation says God, there's not a place where God is not. Then you apply logic to those two premises, and it's, if God is guru, God is everywhere, guru is everywhere. If someone say, where is that verse who says that? Probably there is not. Probably Shastra is waiting for you to think a little bit also. of course, no, because if not, we are like, no, but Shastra has to be saying everything. No, Shastra is saying everything in a way that also invites you to think for yourself and extract what is not being said overtly. No. You follow my point? It's not that everything needs to be said like in your face. You also are expected to think for yourself. That's why many times Shastra uses parok shabad or indirect speech, not to conceal certain things, or the guru himself, herself, will speak in cryptically or in a way that it's not giving the full meal, but it's just giving hints and expecting the student to do their part. Again, it's a teamwork. If not, we became spoiled. Just Gurudev brings everything on a golden plate, and I'm just like, thank you. Another one, please. Thank you. Put me the cupcake directly. With ice cream, please. So yeah, that's important to keep that broadest possible definition. May not be directly in Shastra, it's implied in Shastra. And there are many things that are implied, and we have to be able to extract them, to grasp them. In one sense, you can say everything is inside the Mahamantra, everything is inside the Om. But let's play out the implications of that. That's our tradition. Sometimes we hear, okay, the Om is the original sound. From Om comes Gayatri. From Gayatri comes the first Veda. From the first Veda, four Vedas expand. From the four Vedas, you have Vedanta Sutra, Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita. From that comes Srimad Bhattam. From Srimad Bhattam comes Chaitanya Chaitamrita. Then you have the books of the Sikhs, Goswami. But all that was in the Om. So what happened after was just playing out the implications of it. That's the duty of parampara. And that is an ongoing affair. It's not that, oh, they already did the work for us. Jai Gurudev, Purvacharyas Ki Jai. Now we can rest forever. They have done. That's not praise of the parampara. No, that's laziness. That's complacency. Because again, reality is ever evolving. So there's always a need for further playing out of the implications. No, no matter how much the Goswami have said in their books, and I'm not downplaying the Goswami, no matter how much Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, there's much more to be said. Not because they are less and we are more, no, not in that direction, because the nature of reality is ever evolving. There's always much more to be said about everything. That's why Prabhupada, when he finished the commentary of the Bhagavad Gita, and someone asked him, so what book do you plan to publish next? And he said, maybe the Bhagavad Gita. So I said, but you just published your translation. And he kind of chuckled. Like, you think that just one translation is all that can be said about Bhagavad Gita? One can publish 108 commentaries on the Gita and still you have not said almost anything. Right? That's the spirit of a real seer of truth. No, this is an ongoing affair. So anyhow, I've gone a few other places on the journey. But we are supposed to be students forever and teachers forever. And teacher, as you say, yeah, teacher can be a giver. And again, teacher is also taking responsibility of being elder for someone when the time is necessary. That's also a humility. It's not that I'm always junior because I'm so fallen. No, sometimes you need to be a mother and you have to be an elder to your kids. I mean, it has to happen. If you tell to your two-year-old, we are just friends and we are equals and let's share thoughts about what to do with life, no? And your two-year-old is just waiting to imitate you, as we are saying. He's looking at it like, just tell me what to do and I just copy paste. So I depend on you for survival. Yeah. That's it. You cannot just be a body of your two-year-old. You have to be, there has to be some hierarchy, some elder, some responsibility, some guru-ness. So, and in time that may take different shapes and forms, but that's all in the spirit of service. That's the point. No? Like once, just to conclude, and Madhumati was raising her hand, and also Karuneshwari. Once I remember talking with one Prabhupada disciple, South America, friend of mine, he will tell me, every time I accept disciples, actually, I feel that Srila Prabhupada is sending these people to my life to engage me in his service, so I can increase my discipleship toward my guru. So instead of feeling that I'm accepting disciples, I feel that I am accepting my guru more and more through each disciple. So instead of becoming more and more guru, I become more and more of a disciple. No? And that's how, I mean, he takes the responsibility of being a guru, but in the spirit of being a disciple, right? So that's the idea. It's not like my guruship becomes isolated from my discipleship, but it's just an extension of being a disciple. As I say, being a disciple, if you're a good disciple, you start to become a reference point for many in terms of, for example, in the Gaudiya community. If everybody is very exemplary, very inspiring, people will start to look up to that person as a guy. It's not forced. It's just natural. The attractiveness of his, her realizations and modern practice becomes like people wants to be in touch with that person. It's not, it has to happen like that. It's not like, I don't know, let's make some like formula who will be guru or appointing or some people wanting to be guru and please, what do I have to do to be guru? That's a little weird. No, because the question is why you want that? No. Why? If you want to take care of people and take responsibility, that can happen without signing any paper. It's just doing it. Whatever follows from that in terms of formality, that's Krishna's arrangement, Krishna's will, But I personally would say we should be careful not try to look for that ourselves. No, once one has to be a servant, and if my servanthood creates inspiration in the form of people who look somehow become inspired, in that same servanthood that inspire others, now my servanthood takes the form of accompanying the people in the journey, and whatever that happens as a result of that still needs to be, has to be an expression of my servanthood. As I gave the example, even if eventually someone ends up giving initiation, it should be like the example I gave. I'm accepting my guru more and more. I'm becoming more and more of a disciple. Radhikar Prima Guru Amisishanata. Krishna himself, I'm a disciple of Radha. I mean, God is a disciple. Forever. He's happy to be a student in Radha's school of love. So, I mean, Krishna is happy to be a disciple forever. We should be careful to be equally happy. As I mentioned, radical personalism, just to be a guru is just to be a disciple from a different place. That's it. Not from a different position, from a different function, but it's still discipleship, taking another shape. That's it. Mother Matthew, you had something connection to the topic?
Yes, I was thinking from the mama duck perspective.
From the?
Mama duck perspective.
Yes.
Having been a mama duck and having four little ducklings.
Yeah.
It's some of the joy in that is seeing the potential of each of these four ducklings, and they're all a little bit different.
Mm.
They're all mine, but they're so different, and figure out how to guide them in each different ways. According, I mean, my one son wanted to go into army cadets. Okay. but
he's not you.
He's not me, and I encouraged him, and he flourished that way.
Mm.
And so watch it. So that just seeing the joy of them having their potential, actualizing it. So it's interesting for me to see it from that other direction.
Mm. Thank you.
Seeing them individually.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you say that. Like you're kind of rejoicing in seeing the uniquely individuated flourishing of each person. And again, that's how a guru should be, like relishing that, no? Relishing, seeing, witnessing how his ducklings are becoming unique, no? So to say, no? They are shedding the skin of imitation, so to say, and starting to feel for themselves and think and form their own criteria and have their own experience. And then it's very much father-mother-like because it's the first is more like, okay, I will tell you what is what. No need to go anywhere. Just look at me. Imitate me. And eventually knowing when to let go. When to let go a little bit. Not so much. A little bit more. Don't cross the street. Come here. And at one point, it's like, ooh. And in one sense, even the roles reverse, as we say. Mm-hmm. And the student becomes a teacher. And the father is learning from the children. It's like, wow, what's happening here now?
And that was interesting for me just to, it's given me a little more understanding of how our grooves must feel, just that joy and watching that. I hadn't considered that before.
Yeah. If one doesn't have that, at least that intention to converge in that place, why you are a guru? No, it's like it raises some suspicion. If the more my disciples grow and individuate and think and feel for themselves, I feel threatened as a guru. No, I need to push you down. I need to cancel you. I need to dismiss you. I need to make you basically like flat as an entity. And that speaks about the integrity of my own project, my guru project. No? So. And then comes the question, why, if you don't want to see your disciples to flourish, why are you a guru? What's the actual reason why you are taking that position? Mm-hmm. What's the unresolved issue in your life, probably, that makes you put yourself in some position to keep people on a certain level? And whenever someone starts to flourish more, you cannot tolerate that. So maybe it has something to do with you and not with the disciples flourishing. Why do you follow my path? So that's why, again, we go back. An ideal guru has to have some balanced, integrated humanity and many other elements. So when these things happen, every disciple starts to become its own flower. That is, the guru is celebrating that. Not only is not threatened, but it's in ecstasy seeing that. And again, that's example of the Bhagavatam. Sukadev Goswami is, again, this is not only the disciple of Vyasa, it's the son of Vyasa. So we have the two analogies there, no? Duckling, Papa Duck, Vyasadev, and Sukadev, he's the duckling who is born not as a Gaudiya Vaishnav, so not as a Vaishnav, it's more as a Brahma body, and somehow goes through a whole conversion, so to say, and his father Vyasadev instructs him in the Bhagavatam, and eventually his son becomes Sukadev Goswami, and Vyasa is so much rejoicing, how is it in English, basking in glory, yeah. No, in seeing his own son giving Bhagavad Katha to Parikshit Maharaj, and Vyasadeva is just like cannot contain himself, not to the point, as we said the other day, that he calls his guru Narad, and grandpa comes to this scene.
Yeah.
Now, again, that's a culture of elders. That's a healthy culture of elders. Now the young boy is taking the baton. Now Sukadeva is speaking Bhagavatam. His guru is listening, learning from him, wondering at that. His own, the guru of his guru, they are all, you know, grandfather, father, like learning from the child. So that's the Bhagavatam. So the Bhagavatam, again, maybe we say, but Maharaj, there was not a verse who was saying that Sukadev, that Vyasadeva is showing the example of a guru who is rejoicing in the glory of seeing his disciple flourishing in individuation. Where is the verse that says that? you have to learn to read between the lines. It's there. Again, it's there. The Bhagavatam is not just the verses, it's what's in between the verses, in between the lines, in between the letters and the syllables. Oh, that's a culture of guru, disciple culture the Bhagavatam is seeing. We've missed the mark. Okay, let's shoot again. Let's get closer to the center. So yeah, thank you for
example. Thank you. Well, thank you for the mother duck analogy.
Thank you, Richard. Well, thank you, the ducks, for being born nearby. That and the whole stuff. Yeah,
for being fully who they are.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah, we have to. I think I heard some Christian, I don't know, theologians, philosophers, but they will say that the duck is the favorite animal of God in their own tradition, I think, because the duck can fly, can swim, and can walk.
Oh,
no? So there's something special about the duck. Can't crawl. Let's see. We'll see. Don't spoil the party, Svetlana Radka.
Is it okay to ask a question from what you said in the introduction to tonight's class?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's such a relevant question for everybody, but I think of it every time you speak about saving the life of Radha and Krishna on a daily basis.
It's a little too much, sorry.
No, but it just brings up the same question every time you say it, so you would ask it eventually. So if that's actually before I ask the question, when you were saying about, you know, this Q&A, we will do it in eternity. This afternoon, Lord of mine, I were laughing. This feels like Christmas Day every day.
Especially with the picnic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Spending time with friends and family and nice exchanges and eating and like Christmas every day.
Eating with Faria.
But the question is, if that's the, you know, eternal engagement with this relationship with Radha and Krishna and bringing them together and saving their lives, is that's a different concept than what I understood, funny enough, along with everything else. So is that like in conjugal ras, that's the relationship, it's serving the divine couple Because that seems much nicer than trying to have a relationship directly with Krishna yourself, which is what I understood it to be in the past.
Oh, okay.
Do you understand the question?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, there are many windows of opportunity in our sampradaya. For example, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami will say that Mahaprabhu came to give Chari Bhav, which is the four bhavas of Braj, no? By four means Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. But of course, each one of those have so many subdivisions, no? As Rupa Goswami describes in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And even on top of that, many associates of Mahaprabhu were not even aligned with Braja Bhav. No? You have Murari Gupta, who was Hanuman. And he's welcome also. So Gaur Lila has a lot of depth, but also a lot of breadth. No? So it's welcoming anything and everyone and everything. So I was talking today with Rasangi, who came to visit us. Not you, Rasangi, from California, sorry. we wait for you next time. But yeah, I remember talking to a friend of mine. He has been a Gaudiya. He then went back to Christianity. His eternal prospect is Christ and Mahaprabhu. And he feels that it's possible due to the Audarya disposition of Gaur Lila. So that's a whole conversation. But in connection to your question, of course, at the same time, we have this thing, okay, but Mahaprabhu came to specially give certain particular mode. Anarpita charim chidat karunayava tirnakalu samarpajum unnata uchvalarasam savaktishriyam. Which sometimes is translated as manjari bhav, radha dasyam, the mode of the manjari. Which no doubt there's lots of emphasis on that in our tradition, and no doubt most sadhakas in our sampradaya have that affinity, which doesn't mean that that's the only possibility. So we should be careful of not going to the extreme of saying this is the only possibility and anything else is bogus or deviant, or they did some aparad and because of that they were downgraded to something lower than the highest thing. And we enter again in this hierarchical better, worse, us and them stuff. So So in terms of your specific question, Rupa Goswami speaks of two types of romantic love. One being the aspiration to relate directly to Krishna romantically. Because again, Madhurya Rasa has these subdivisions. I will spare you of the technical details and the terminologies. But in general, he will say, Kantabhav. There's one terminology. So Kantabhav means... Kantva means the direct connection to Krishna as a lover of him. And then comes Manjari Bhav. Manjari Bhav, the mood of the Manjaris is they don't want direct connection to Krishna, even when Krishna is suggesting that. There are many instances in Shastra, many prayers of our Goswamis in their Manjari Swarup, where Krishna is coming to them and they're praying to Krishna, please, Krishna, I don't want to have anything to do with you directly. My most earnest prayer is to serve you and Sri Radha at the same time. The two of you together are my Ishtadev, the object of my worship, is to see the two of you together. That's the perfection of my eyes. Don't look a separate relationship with me. And Krishna will test that and will insist, and the Manjaris will like, even sometimes Sri Radha will tell Krishna, go and harass that Manjari, so to say. Just to see the loyalty of the Manjari's mood blossom. That's basically the idea. And everyone will be fully satisfied by that. So again, generally in our sampradaya, when we speak about romantic love, conjugal love, however you may like to call it, Madhurya Rasa, Madhurya Bhava, the main emphasis is Manjari Bhav, which does not include a direct connection to Krishna. Even if Krishna sometimes may try to force the whole thing, for whatever purpose, the spirit of the mantra is, I don't want to step to, I want to enjoy Radha's union with Krishna. That will be my, that's my glory, that's my enjoyment, to see the two of them, and vicariously is in English. That's the way that the mantras are. That's tadatmya. That's a form of tadatmya. I'm so empathic with Radha's experience with Krishna that these different symptoms and things that she's experiencing start to manifest in the body of the manjaris world. Well, they are many times like, how to say, like peeping from the lattice.
Yes.
About the romantic union with Radha and Krishna. That's their way. So that's the main emphasis. But again, I know devotees in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, I don't need to enter into names, who want Kantava, who wants direct romantic interaction with Bhagavan. So that may not be the cup of tea of some, but that will be the cup of tea, the chalice, you say, of some. So, so again, it's not a deviation, it's not something bad, it's not something, as long as it's fueled by sincere motivation, that's in itself glorious. Even it has, I mean, we have been talking already, people, you want to merge into Brahman, that has a place in eternity. So that's glorious in its own way. What to speak if you want to have romantic connection with Krishna? I mean, what to speak of that then? So that would be how I will speak about it. There is the main emphasis, the main window of opportunity, but that doesn't mean that any other variety of that same conjugal love is to be seen as this disposable or anything. Yeah. Does it make sense? Or there's something else you would like to ask?
It completely makes sense, 100%. I just hesitated to say something because it's like so way above where I'm at that I feel like totally unqualified to make any comment on it. So it's just a logic comment rather than like a realization comment, which is like just logically it would seem that if you're worshipping Radha Krishna, that would be more of a natural move because you're serving them as a couple. Rather than just directly trying to have a relationship with Krishna or Radha Krishna.
That's the main, like the famous song from Narottam Das Thakur, Radha Krishna Pranamora Jugala Kishore Jiva Nemarani Rati Nahi Anymore. Like Radha Krishna Jugal means the couple. So Jugal Kishore, this young youthful couple, they are my life and soul. The two together, not one, not only the other. They don't only, of course, the Manjaris are known for Radha Dasyam, for being exclusively dedicated to her, but their dedication to her is in the context of her union with him. No, it's not like they hate Krishna or something like that. No, and we love Radha so much that they know. I mean, they love Radha so much that they know what's Radha's heart. So they love Krishna naturally. But they love Krishna in their own unique way. No? It's not that they don't love Krishna. That would be kind of the famous example of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He was once at Radha Kunda with his devotees, and then came a person from the government and started to do Dandavat Parikram to Radha Kunda. One devotee came and told Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, he's doing Danda Parikram to Radha Kund. He must have so much devotion for Radha. And Prabhupada said, yes, but his devotion is different from ours. He's worshipping Krishna because he's the favorite of Radha. That was his Manjaribhav biased perspective. We have something to do with Krishna in the context, of Radha. No. Some other people will be the opposite. We are not criticizing them. It's just like they're different, again, perspectives, and that perspective will create different order of priorities, so to say. The Priyanarma Sakas will be basically the same, but in the other direction, in one sense. They're friends of Krishna who are familiar with his romantic life, and they're assisting Krishna to get united with Radha. But her main focus is Krishna. Again, it's not that they're dismissed, Radha, because she's so important for him. They give their life for creating their union. Yeah. Okay. Back to us.
I have something to comment on. Sweta Dweeps. I was, it came the other day and I was reminded, I think we are always growing the fact that.
Always growing?
Each of us.
Mm.
That we can help someone learn that they are either lovable or they are not lovable. Mm. Like in any interaction that we have, even with the cashier at the store.
Mm.
We're in a position to help people learn that about themselves, that they are lovable or that they are unlovable.
Yeah, thank you. If you want to think of the guru as someone who is giving a message, no? When Guru comes and gives the lecture, okay, what's the message the Guru Dev is giving? But what's the message you are leaving to the cashier in the supermarket? What's the message you're giving to each of you in our last interaction half an hour ago? There's always a message being given, a teaching or something.
Yeah, so, I was thinking something like that in simple terms.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, like a contribution thing. Because just coming from what you said, Bhaktirasa, about our interactions with people can be like a message to them, you know, in terms of being almost like a spontaneous in the moment, like always kind of that opportunity. There's a lady who works in the corner shop down the road, and it was just kind of like a spontaneous thing where she kind of, every time she gives me the receipt, she lovingly folds it into like, it's just like it's not like a shape or anything, but it just came as like this. So every time she's simple, but I think sometimes that can happen. You know, you can almost take on I don't know. It's almost like disciple guru, guru disciple, kind of almost like a perpetual kind of alternating thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where she's giving something, you know, imparting something special, almost unspoken in a way. And then your receiving is kind of way giving back.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think that the gift can be like a I had it and then I didn't have it. The gift just almost like that symbol, like it has depth. There's no need for deeper context, you know, than that. But it's just a spontaneous, like an alternating.
Yeah, I appreciate the last point you mentioned. It doesn't need to be deeper, in the sense that I know I'm having this interaction with the cashier. Probably we won't have time to get to know each other and become best friends, because I may meet 10 cashiers per day, and but given the circumstances, what can I offer in that 10-second interaction to make a difference, right? To make the world a better place, as they will say. And literally, I mean, there is a commitment. What's my contribution in that particular moment? Vice versa,
of course.
Yeah. Like we were talking today also with Rasangi, like, because sometimes we have a very idealized, over-idealized notion of what it means to help people or to make a contribution. It's just go to the street and give a book or whatever. Certain ideas that qualify as compassion, help, making a difference. And in the name of pursuing those, sometimes we end up not being so compassionate, so kind, so empathic, and it's just get the book, or more than that, give me the money, depending on the case. And sometimes it's just giving the person a moment of unconditional listening and acceptance. And that created more an aha moment and a samskara of transformation that the whole collection of Bhagavatam distributed. Without dismissing that distribution, again, as long as it goes with the element of compassion and presence. But sometimes you don't have anything to give externally, but you can give presence, you can give unconditional acceptance, listening, and that's the main thing to give, and that's the main thing to receive. It's always reciprocal. That's why Rupa Goswami, he puts them all of them in pairs of giving and receiving gifts, giving and receiving prasad, giving and receiving your, or just receive, he says. Both have to be functioning. Both sides of the street have to be operative. And yeah, guru and disciple is both ends. As guru you give, but as guru also you receive. As disciple you give, as disciple you receive in your own unique way. So we have to be trained in both things. Sometimes we have been quote unquote trained to give, surrender, dedicate, and receiving is not in the script, so to say. No, I don't have receiving will be exploiting, selfish, arrogant. No, you have to learn how to receive in a way that is humbling, in a way that is moving, in a way that is supporting the interaction. It's not just giving. Sometimes we don't want to be loved. Sometimes our goal is to love Krishna, but how much we allow ourselves to be loved. If I don't give myself permission to even acknowledge that Krishna loves me. Like we were giving the example of the Dalai Lama the other day, right? Of self-hatred. And I was not with you.
No.
Oh, no. Sorry. It was in yesterday's Zoom call I was having. Aww. And I was like, what happened, guys? Such a bad memory you have. So I will give the example here. So a few years ago when the Dalai Lama went to the West first time, he was in the conference. He was already aware of the workings of the mind, of the Western mind, so to say, because there are some different features. And he will come, of course, decades ago, and he was giving, I think, a lecture, and someone asked him, so how to work with self-hatred? So he didn't understand the question. He thought he was listening bad, wrongly. So he had a translator at that time because his English was not the best. And he was like, so he was 15 minutes trying to understand the question. He thought that the hatred was coming from someone else, an enemy. This, the word self referred to just until here, and he was shocked. And he said, I thought I understood the workings of the Western mind, but this is new to me. Wow. Self-hatred. And he said that from that moment, he changed all his presentation toward the West to the point of, first, you have to learn to love yourself. At one point, you need to learn to forget yourself. But if you don't even first love yourself, you don't have a self to forget about. Really? So first, you need to integrate and accept and love yourself. Then we can talk about self-sacrifice and self-forgetfulness in divine love. But if you don't even have a self that you have accepted, you cannot... forget about that, so to say. Follow my point?
Mm-hmm.
So something that connection with what we're talking just now. Well, back to Teresa. Sorry?
Story is quickly to illustrate what you were saying. Srila Prabhupada, I think it was taken sitting in a car every day. They would go for a walk and he would look really depressed. He was just sitting in the driver's seat and he'd have his window open a little bit. And every day they would go and he was there. And one morning Srila Prabhupada walked over to his car. And that was it. He walked away and all the devotees were like shocked because he didn't say Hare Krishna. He didn't. Any of them. He said
he didn't even give him a cookie.
No book.
Yeah.
Nothing. He just said, "Good morning."
Yeah.
And then walked away.
Yeah. He acknowledged his existence.
Yeah.
Because many people, and that's research. Research shows people in homeless conditions. One of the main, the thing that pulls them down the most is the fact that they're just lying there and everyone walks like if they don't exist. In good morning, like acknowledging their presence, not like they're an invisible bug lying on my side, because that's one idea.
Yeah.
I mean, don't think they have a very strong self-esteem problem in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
No? An environment that basically tells you you don't exist. So maybe the best thing you can do is just acknowledge their existence by saying good morning or whatever. No, of course, if you can want to give something else, okay. But on the foundation of acknowledging, okay, you here you are, and sometimes you don't need to be a homeless person in order to be a necessity of that. Some of us may have grown neglected by, I don't know, parents or. Without any bad intention, but I don't know, parents who were emotionally unavailable, and somehow that gives you the message of you're not important, you're not as important, you do not exist. So many of us, again, first need to start to exist. Again, going back to this Dalai Lama situation, that maybe first there's, instead of trying to jump to Manjari Bab, we need to start existing. I'm not saying everyone, I'm not trying to force it, but in many cases, in my limited experience, I see many members of the Gaudiya community which still have the problems of self-hatred and self-loathing and problems with their own existence. So how can we just go and try to talk about Leelas in Vrindavan, hoping that magic will happen? No, there's some things need to be in place first. If I do not acknowledge my own existence and I'm absolutely fractured and dismantled, how I'm perceiving Radha and Krishna, which are the lenses through which I'm, what's my idea of God? So sometimes we need to do deep work in that, in the service of Manjari Bab, to say. It's not separated. I remember we gave that lecture in Alachua some months ago. It's three lectures on self-love in bhakti, maybe you recall. And I think one day before that, we have been celebrating, I think it was Gadadhar Pandit's appearance or something like that. So we were like talking about the highest of the highest.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are talking about self-love. And it's like, so I try to make that point, they're not separated. This foundation, this depth in foundation is in the service of the highest peaks, the highest reach of our tradition. So you were raising your hand, the two of you.
Yeah, it's just to add on to what Bhakti Rasa said, you know, this was the point that was in our local Tesco's when I lived in England, and they were trying to shut all the tills down.
What's tills? Sorry.
The tills,
the cash register.
Cash registers.
Okay.
Yeah. And make everything automated, you know.
Mm.
And we said to them, to the management, and also to the ladies that were on the cash registers, that you are probably the only person that some of these elderly people see during the day.
Mm.
and to have a conversation with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they agreed with us, didn't they?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, loads of people were there, and then there was sort of started this whole movement where they ignored the automatic, the cash cashiers, mm-hmm. to keep them there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Okay, first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's true. You know, these elderly people, they'll go there and, they, you know, they'll chat to the cashier and mm-hmm. she'll chat back mm-hmm. and ask how they're doing and everything. And then what they've done now to the little coffee areas where they go and they get their little coffee, you know, and outing for the day, they mm-hmm. made it all automated.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, that same principle can be applied in so many areas with everything becomes more... dehumanized basically. We don't need humans here, we don't need human, but that also mm-hmm. takes the human interaction.
Yeah. And then they wonder why depression is
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just following on from what you were saying about how we're, you know, to work on a humanist, and that sometimes people speak about, you know, Manjari Bhavana, avoiding all of what needs to be dealt with, or if there's brokenness there to be dealt with. Is that some, you know, it's very common knowledge that the thing is, well, you know, almost the time of death has become an anger of bhakti in itself that will transform you, as if it's, you know, it has its... We're dying, you know, all the time, but somehow or another it's become like a part of a spiritual cleansing experience that at that moment there's a whole bunch of stuff going on and you're going to pop out, you know, there's a Manjari on the other end. You know, it's kind of become over...
Yeah. Over-idealized.
Yeah.
Over-idealizing death.
Yeah.
Of course, I get the point, and of course, I don't. Bhagavad Gita says, "Jam jam bhavishmaram baram tya jante ante kali baram tam tami bhaiti kaunteya sadatat bhava bhavita." Whatever state of consciousness you have, leaving your body, that's where you go. So it makes it pretty clear that you go where you want to go. Right? So, yeah. I mean, if you don't want to go to Golok Vrindavan, you won't go to Golok Vrindavan. And I'm not being cruel by saying that. On the contrary, I'm being kind, respecting your choice. And I'm speaking for Krishna here. Krishna is saying that if you don't want to come to Golok, I won't force you. I'm not that bad. I'm not that cruel. If you want to do something else, do something else. And you will go wherever your choices are taking you. Which again, for us, most of us, is terrifying because it means, oh, I have some responsibility in life. It doesn't happen everything automatic by magic, and I have to stop being myself. No, that is that you are yourself.
Sometimes we think that we want to go to Goloka as more of a to get out.
Yeah,
and that the death will transform and make that all happen.
Yeah, yeah. Like I mentioned in the book, many times we think of spirituality as an evacuation plan for into the afterlife. Just let's get out of here. And as we talk these days, Golok, Vrindavan, spiritual world, it's a state of consciousness. So if you are not there in consciousness, you are not going anywhere. And if you are there, you are there. That's it. No. And that said, I will say one nuance to the answer. Of course, we have been through that. We have gone through death so many times. We don't recall probably, but we have at least experiences from near-death experiences and things like that in which we know people that in that moment also there are certain things happening. There's some certain, even the very collapse of certain functions and things push the soul to a particular type of awareness. So even if you didn't have, let's say, certain focus and determination in certain aspects of your life, maybe in those last moments certain things collapse and allows you to have a vision of what truly matters, and you can take a particular intense decision that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. No? So I wouldn't also totally undermine, but I know that your question comes more from a place of magical thinking and and just try to, yeah, just not doing so much in my lifetime and expecting full magic at death. And some magic may happen, but do not live your life as full. The whole of the magic has to happen in that very moment, because that's not. And again, the point is that, and this is basic, but we may have missed the lesson, that the devotee doesn't care what happens after death. That's the point. that sounds a little like discouraging, but Narayana Parasarvina Kutashan Vivyati Swarga Pabarga Narakesu Apituliarta Darshana. That's the Bhagavatam, see? The devotee of Bhagavan, for him, for her, it's the same to go to heaven, to hell. They doesn't care, because they already arrived where they had to arrive. So what happens after death? No idea. No idea in one sense. In another sense is, I have an idea. I'm practicing bhakti. I want to practice bhakti. And Krishna is merciful enough, so to say, more than that, of course, but to allow me to continue practicing bhakti. So I have full trust. I have full trust that Krishna is maintaining and protecting me, and he will continue to do so. That's it. All the other details, no clue and no care for that. That's Mahaprabhu's fourth verse in Shikshastaka. Mama janmani janmanishwari bhavatat bhakti rahaitukit. As long as that doesn't answer bhavatar bhakti rahaitukit. Bhavatar says, no? Sabaipun samparo dharmo yato bhakti radokshaye haitukiya pratihata. Jayatma supersede. The haituki means unmotivated. No. Unmotivated doesn't mean without motivation. No? but without any further motivation than engaging in bhakti for its own sake. So bhakti is its own reward. Bhakti is for its own sake. So Mahaprabhu said, haituki pratihata janmani janmanishvare bhavatat bhakti haituki. I don't care nadanam, najanam, nasunda. I don't care for wealth, for this, for that, for this, for not even for mukti. As long as I can engage in a haituki bhakti, as long as I can embrace bhakti for the sake of bhakti, mama janmani janmani. I can be born over and over and over again, and I'm totally fine with that. That birth represents the stage of ruchi. Ruchi means taste, real deep tasting. But when you have a real taste in bhakti, you have so much taste in bhakti that, again, you don't care for anything else. But what will happen after that? No idea, I don't care. I have so much taste in bhakti. And my taste will drive me. I trust my taste. Okay. No? So I think that's an important point. Because sometimes we become too much of a strategizers. Yeah. What will happen after death and how to and actually that's funny, because that's in the Bhagavad Gita, you study chapter 8, and Krishna speak about different yogis, not devotees, other people making all these arrangements to live under the right influence and constellations, so after dying. But it's clear that those are not the devotees, but the devotees are those who are trying to make all those astrological calculations, so to say. And in one point Prabhupada even said, he said, for a devotee, he doesn't care, and probably when he leaves his body, if he's so absorbed in bhakti, he doesn't even know that he left his body. Imagine that. No? Yeah. He was so occupied in something else, in serving Krishna, that, hey, you died. Oh, okay. I'm too busy serving now. Sorry. No? So that means you are beyond liberation. Liberation implies this concern with death and where I will go after. I don't want to return. Post-liberation means you don't care. You don't even notice death. You are so engaged in bhakti that death happened and you continue in the uninterrupted flows. Sorry, what?
That happened and we're all already dead. We just don't know.
Yeah.
In a room in Goloka Vrindavan.
So that's extreme to which Prabhupada spoke about, that you can die and even you don't notice you die. Which for other people it's like, that's the most noticeable moment and main thing that will happen. But when you realize that the main thing that is happening is bhakti, everything else is like lose priority. No? So that, and that's his emphasis. Our emphasis is not to calculate, strategize our evacuation plan for the afterlife in the right constellation, but just be as present, as open, as surrender to bhakti here and now. And that's it. Trust the flow, trust the rest of what happens, what comes after that. Krishna himself is saying that so many times in the scripture. Like, you try to give yourself to bhakti, that's it. No, you don't need to be making master plans for anything else. No, that's the master plan. Everything else is taken care of, so to say. Heaven takes care of itself, so to say. Okay. Okay, one more.
Okay.
Yeah, one more, because it's to be 8, and I know there is some other local gathering. Yeah, we can have a few minutes. Yeah. Radha Priya, yes.
I really wanted to say something in connection with the fluidity of guru and disciple being, and maybe everybody knows, but it reminded me of when Prabhupada was speaking to his disciples.
Mm-hmm.
He was weeping and saying, "Thank you, you were helping me to serve my guru."
Thank you. And that in turn reminds me of his own guru, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. There is a famous Vyasa Puja lecture he gave. He was his last Vyasa Puja before leaving his body, and he will talk to his disciples. You can look for that, it's famous. He talks in that same mood. He says, like, "Hey, I'm here, sit on this big seat, talking to all of you in my day." He starts to talk to his, but actually, he speaks to his disciples, "Actually, you are all my gurus." And he starts to speak and praise to each one of his disciples, "As you are my guru, there, because you are engaging me in this, and because of that, and I'm serving you." Now, you can imagine how the disciples were feeling. So that again, and you are mentioning Prabhupada. So again, that's the descending current. That's how it's supposed to be. That's how it's supposed to. And it's not a mere formality. Okay, it's my birthday, I have to say some kind things to people, but actually I don't believe them. You know, they are there. So Tadu Radhika, we'll conclude with this one.
Okay. It's a question of today's class, actually. You were talking about mystery, like God being a mystery to us and we being a mystery to him and him being a mystery to himself.
Yes.
And I was thinking in Bhagavad Gita, he also says how, like, you know, he knows past, present, future.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, like, then it almost seems like he knows what's going to happen in the future. Like, you know, I don't know if it is like us in terms of like what we are going to be or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're saying it's a mystery, and it makes sense, because otherwise it might be a bit boring to already know what's going to happen to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, kind of want to understand how, I mean, what does it mean when he says he knows past, present, future?
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's a mystery.
That's a long conversation.
Sorry.
No, don't feel sorry. Yeah, sometimes there are different stances in the connection, but I appreciate the point, because, yeah, how to harmonize that God may not know something. We are not making less of Krishna by saying that. No? Again, it has to be done in a skillful way that it adds charm. So what it means that he knows everything, especially future, no? Because you can say, okay, he can be aware of all the tasks already happened, or what's that's taking place. But what about all that is will take place in the future? And some theologians, and again, there are different views, but this is an interesting one. They will say, God knows about all possible outcomes for the future. In that sense, he knows the future. He knows all possible outcomes, but he cannot be certain about future events in specific detail, as they are not yet knowable. They have not happened yet, so to say. That's one way of saying, of explaining that. It's a nuanced omniscience, you could say, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. Like saying, okay, human actions that have not happened yet do not exist in one way. Mm-hmm. What you will be doing tomorrow does not exist yet. And you have those must be freely chosen by you. No, that's the point. If those actions were absolutely known in detail and this will happen, we will say there, and that becomes a little technical, but that those actions will pre-exist the moment of their choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And somehow they are rendering the act of choosing them like an illusion or something like that. I will leave it at that. Yeah, and it's almost 8, and I know there's another gathering here for some of you, not all of us, but some of you. So you may need some minutes in between. So we'll continue tomorrow in the morning. We'll meet for one more day, penultimate meeting in terms of the 7 pillars. We'll be talking about the realm of contemplative prayer. So see you tomorrow. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai. Shri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai. Sadhu Sangha ki jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Premananda Hari Bhu. Vanchakalpataru Vishakripa Sindhu Pyeva Chapatita Nampavani.